And so as scientists, we can begin to actually look at simulations of what the world would do if we just continue status quo using fossil fuel-based fossil fuels to power our economy, power our world, rely heavily on coal and oil. Under those scenarios, sure, the global population increases, etc. The world warms by 4 to 5 degrees Celsius by the end of the 21st century. And recall that that happy medium for coffee was 18 to 22 Celsius. Mm-hmm. It's about 4 degrees Celsius. So a 4 mm-hmm. degrees Celsius warming globally would effectively 100% wipe out where coffee is growing today.
This episode is proudly brought to you by Mapper Forward's workshop, It's Time to Become a Coffee Consultant. Learn how to diversify your revenue streams and create freedom from your day job while saying goodbye to that alarm clock forever by becoming a consultant within the coffee industry or directly to consumers who have shifted towards home brewing and home roasting. Protect your income from challenging times in the coffee value chain by taking this course today. Go to mapperforward.coffee/workshops or click the link in the show notes for details.
Welcome to the Daily Coffee Pro by Mapper Forward, friends. I'm your host, Lee Safar, and joining me is John Abbotzoglou from the University of California. You are a professor there. You teach climate, talk about climate, research climate. And surely somewhere there, John, there's some hope for coffee and climate change. Help.
There has to be hope. One of the issues when talking about climate change is we typically get into this doom and gloom cycle.
Uh-huh.
Which, as a scientist, is sort of interesting. But from the general public's perspective, doom and gloom is certainly a way of shutting everything down.
Right.
Giving up and dismissing it. Because that's sort of our reaction to hearing bad news. Is we just, mm-hmm. there's no hope. Science actually shows that there is hope, right? And so when we look at, like, we go back to our climate models, or we look at sort of past Earth history, we know that there are ways in which there are ways to slow down or bend this curve on this escalating warming that we've seen. Solutions are out there. There are ways to slow down climate change through reducing the carbon emissions, right? Investing in carbon sequestration strategies. And, I mean, I have several reasons for hope. One, we talked about it earlier, the idea that there are the younger generations, millennial Gen Z, are valuing climate change as a top priority.
Mm-hmm.
As that begins to trickle into business decisions, businesses that might not necessarily be interested in climate change may realize that for them to sell, they need to actually invest in some of these solutions. Right?
Into greenwashing.
There's that side too, right? I think the other thing that, again, like, would motivate sort of some of the solutions is that we begin to start seeing the impacts of climate change take a toll on either human life or economic system.
Mm.
Because a lot of the arguments against acting on climate change are maybe less about the science and more about the cost of actually implementing solutions. So any transition is hard. If we try to transition from, you know, this fossil fuel-based system that powers most of the world today to other sort of sources of energy, doing that instantaneously is not going to happen, right? There'd be a lot of harms in doing that. It's going to cost us money. Right. It's going to cost us money. But again, like, maybe the money that we spend today to work on these solutions begins to offset the cost of doing nothing. Right. Because the cost of doing nothing means that people, businesses, sectors like the coffee sector will be substantially impacted. And then there's the idea that if we act on climate change through these solutions, that those solutions actually create a whole new sector of jobs and labor force.
Mm.
So there are some things, like, you know, if we look at some of this, again, little building blocks towards solutions. None of these are a silver bullet. They're all just little building blocks. I think like 20 years ago, the cost of solar photovoltaic energy was super high, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't have solar panels. Forget about it. It was super, super high, way higher than the status quo of using fossil fuel-based energy. Today, the cost of solar energy is actually quite comparable to the cost of fossil fuel-based energy. And the adoption rates have skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. Now you begin to see, okay, now it's no longer such a barrier. Adoption has increased dramatically. Same sorts of things are showing up with electric vehicles as well. So there are these incremental changes that are happening that are slow changes, right? It can help solve, at least avoid the worst case scenarios. And so as scientists, we can begin to actually look at simulations of what the world would do if we just continue status quo using fossil fuel-based, fossil fuels to power our economy, power our world, rely heavily on coal and oil. Under those scenarios, sure, the global population increases, et cetera. The world warms by 4 to 5 degrees Celsius by the end of the 21st century. And recall that that happy medium for coffee was 18 to 22 Celsius. Mm-hmm. It's about 4 degrees Celsius. So a 4 degrees Celsius warming globally would effectively 100% wipe out where coffee is growing today. Other solutions, other simulations, if you will, involve transitioning away from carbon-based fuels, right? Say over the next 20 to 30 to 40 years, right? Maybe by 2050, we reduce our carbon emissions by half of what they are today. Under those scenarios, the Earth still warms, right? Maybe it warms by another 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, but that gives us enough time to actually implement some of these solutions, these transition solutions. And that's the hope that I have for climate change. The same thing goes for the coffee industry. There are these solutions that we can implement to solve climate change, like we've talked about. And then there's the on-farm adaptation approaches through regenerative agriculture, agroforestry, things that will, and maybe even some of the genetic experiments with coffee, things that will allow coffee to continue to thrive where it exists today. Mm-hmm. But using different management or technologies.
It seems that when I hear you speak, it's not like we're not smart enough to fix this problem. It's not like we don't have the resources to solve this problem. It sounds like we would be fucking morons as a civilization if money and effort were the things that stopped us from solving this problem. Because it sounds like a solvable problem from where we're looking at right now. The hypothesis is that anyway.
It's a solvable problem, but it's one that requires global effort.
Yeah.
Right? Coordination. And it's not like, so we you know, globally we have identified air quality or pollution that we see directly impacts human health as a problem. And there have been a lot of efforts to clean up air, right? We saw that in the 1970s with Clean Air Acts. The thing about air pollution is it's local, right? So if you have industrial activity near you or there's a lot of traffic activity, you see an increase in fine particulate matter, ozone, et cetera.
Right.
And if you implement a policy to reduce those local impacts, it'll benefit the local or regional area. Climate change is global.
Yeah.
And so really requires coordination. And realistically, it's going to have to be led by the industrialized nations to act on. And it's not clear to me that things are happening fast enough. But I think we've avoided the worst case scenarios.
So far.
Some of the changes. So far over the last 10 years, there have been some things that give me a little bit of hope. But
okay.
We're still behind the curve. And that's the little bit of hope is that there globally, we've seen basically a flattening out in carbon emission. Right. So realistically,
cooking the books a little bit though, John?
Well, we have to get carbon emissions by collecting information globally. And in China, there's some challenges in getting good ideas of what's happening. But like I mentioned, even though like carbon emissions are maybe not increasing, carbon dioxide concentrations are continuing to increase because we have this imbalance, more carbon into the atmosphere versus carbon taken out of the atmosphere. It's like a bathtub that you're basically filling faster than it's draining. And so
rise.
So a little bit of optimism there, a lot more work to do though.
Do you know much about cloud seeding?
A little bit on cloud seeding, yeah.
You know, we have a lot of that here in Dubai.
Really? Okay, I did not realize that.
And they're open about it. They'll tell you, and they release videos on it. They show you how they do it. And we have had rain almost... we had rain 4 weeks in a row, I think. And they're openly tell you here, we do cloud seeding. We make it rain. And boy, do they fucking make it rain. Like the whole city gets sort of flooded. It's a thing that they're looking food security. In order to maintain food security, you need water. We're a desert. You know, it's not a hard story to figure out how to tell it. I mean, I wondered, the one thing I've always wondered is, what is the impact of cloud seeding on climate change?
Great question. So clouds are a really important component of our climate system, right? Besides the fact that they're sort of necessary for precipitation.
Mm-hmm.
Clouds are bright. So if you look at clouds from space, they obscure, right? If you look at a satellite imagery, you see... Mm-hmm. Bright surface. And so when you have a bright surface, you're actually not letting as much of the sunlight reach the surface of the earth.
Okay.
And so that can provide a cooling mechanism.
Okay.
So there are some wild ass ideas, right, that say, hey, we're not going to solve the carbon issue, but we want to modify the earth system such that there's less sunlight reaching the earth.
Right.
And these are people. Solar radiation management, it sounds like it's some sort of a governmental, but it's really getting into this, like, you know, climate science fiction world. And some of the scenarios are, you know, where the earth is dark, which is over the oceans, let's increase cloud cover there. Let's have some automated ships that go back and forth in the Pacific and basically create clouds, reflect radiation back out to space. We can do that over certain areas as well that increase precipitation to increase food production. Great. The challenge with all of this, though, is that do we really want to play these games with our planet?
I know. It's kind of freaky. Like, just so that we can explain for people who have never heard of the term cloud seeding or think it's a myth, it's absolutely not a myth. They talk openly about it here in the United Arab Emirates. There's no shame around it. They are very proud of the fact that they do it. And cloud seeding is when you see a cloud that's coming, and what you do is you send a plane up into the sky and it circles around it and it waits for a draft that is coming underneath the cloud. And they have these flares that are attached to the plane, and these flares are filled with salt. And so they release these flares underneath the cloud, and the draft kind of pulls that salt up inside the cloud, and the salt fills up with the water that's in that cloud. And then the weight of that salt is now heavier than the draft that's pulling it up. And then they make it rain, folks. That's how they make it rain. That's what cloud seeding is. And they do it a lot here.
Fascinating. So one of the weird things about cloud seeding is that ultimately you're removing water from the atmosphere when you have precipitation. And so they talk about doing this. They do some of this in the Western United States, specifically to cloud seed over the mountains where they can store the water as mountain snowpack, which is a great reservoir for later in the year when there's no rain. The interesting issue with cloud seeding is that by removing moisture in the atmosphere, it may rain more where you are, but that means it doesn't rain.
It's taking it from somewhere else.
So it's, it's a really interesting challenge.
And in a country like the United States, I can see that people are going to start creating lawsuits over who owns what cloud and who owns what water that's precipitated in the cloud. And no, Oregon stole the water from California. And, you know, you stole a cloud before it was supposed to arrive in California. We're going to sue you for water deprivation. I have no idea where that's going.
I saw that cloud first. It's mine.
Hey, it's the US. It's not unlikely that something like that could happen. Anyway, John, this has been an amazing series. Thank you very much. This has been very, very helpful. If people want to listen to any of your lectures, or if they want to check out some of your work, where do they, because there are a lot of coffee producers that listen to this podcast, and there are a lot of scientists in the coffee world that listen to this podcast, and they may be interested to find out more about climate change. So where can people check out what you do?
Best place to go is probably my website, climatologylab.org.
Okay. We'll have links in the show notes for people. Are you on social media?
I am on Twitter or X, climate_guy.
I love that. That's fantastic. We will have links in the show notes below, folks. John, we ask our guests to sign off the last episode of every series with peace, love, and peanut butter. Would you do that for us?
Peace, love, and peanut butter.
Have an amazing rest of your day, everyone. Bye.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode, friends. Please don't forget to show us some love by subscribing, liking, commenting, and most of all, sharing this podcast with your friends. Check the show notes for links, including our sponsors and our Patreon. And stay tuned for more great conversations on The Daily Coffee Pro by Mapper Forward.